Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is Vayechi. It means, and he lived. The Torah portion is Genesis 47, verse 28 to chapter 50, verse 26. The Haftarah is 1 Kings, chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, and the Brit Hadashah is 1 Peter 1, verses 3 to 9. This Torah portion is kind of a strange in the way that it starts out. It says, and he lived. That's what Vayechi means. Yet, in this Torah portion, we read that Jacob dies. And as a matter of fact, when we get into the Torah portion a little further on, we're going to find that it was Israel who was dying, but yet he lived. There's some very profound thinking that needs to go on about that. Let's go to Genesis 47, verse 28. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. And the time drew near that Israel must die, see? And he called his son Joseph and said to him, if now I have found grace in your sight, I pray, put your hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray you, in Egypt. But I will lie with my fathers, and you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. And he, that's Joseph, said, I will do as you have said. And he, that's Jacob, swear to me, he said, and he swore to him, and Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. In other words, Israel here is dying, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on to find out exactly what does that mean, that Israel was dying. But we see here that once there is the promise that Israel will be taken to the land, then he is at peace. He bows himself upon the bed's head. I want to point out that in this Torah portion in particular, as well as other places, but since we're in this Torah portion, when you read about Jacob, we're talking about the man. When we read about Israel, we're talking about the nation. And so most of the time when it's talking about Israel, it's talking about prophecies. This Torah portion is so full of prophecy, I just don't even know where to begin with it. Now, we know that Jacob has to be buried in Israel as he required. Why is that? Because if he is not buried in Israel, then he cannot claim his inheritance, you see. Bones buried outside of Israel is the same as being in exile forever. Jacob's bones returning to Israel, and then later Joseph's bones as well, indicates a prophecy of our return to Israel to get our inheritance. So if Jacob is not buried in Israel, then we don't have claim to Israel, because the bones of all of our ancestors must be there. And by the way, remember those dry bones? They return to Israel as well. But this time, when those bones are returning to Israel, they're not dry bones anymore. They're Jacob's and Joseph's bones coming together, enlivened by the Ruach, and made into one whole house of Israel, also known as the house of Jacob, in the Lord's hands, you see? Now let's go to Genesis 48, verse 1. And it came to pass after these things that someone told Joseph, behold, your father is sick. And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And someone told Jacob and said, behold, your son Joseph comes to you. And Israel strengthened himself and sat upon the bed. Now, we've got this verse 2 here mixing Jacob and Israel. Because look, someone said to Jacob that your son Joseph is coming to you. and Israel strengthened himself. Now, in a sense, of course, Jacob and Israel are the same person, but there is prophecy in this verse. The death of Jacob here is being used to illustrate the coming death of Israel. Now, I know that we believe that Israel is not going to die, but Israel is going to feel as though it is dying. Now, Israel won't die because both Jacob's and Joseph's bones are awaiting resurrection in the land of their inheritance. This, though, is more of a reference to us, Israel, in the end of days when we lose our strength. What is the loss of our strength? Well, it's the loss of understanding of Torah. It's the loss of wisdom of Torah. It's the loss of the numbers of people who continue keeping the covenant and the Torah. When we lose understanding and wisdom, we do lose our strength. How do we go about losing our understanding and wisdom? By not keeping the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. We lose our strength. Notice that Israel strengthened himself. So how is it that Israel will be strengthened in the end of days? Well, by keeping the weightier matters of the law, by getting back to justice, mercy, and faith, and also through the blessings that Jacob is going to give to Joseph, Manasseh, and Ephraim, and to all the other tribes, and we will be strengthened by the restoration of Judah and Joseph, by the whole house of Israel coming together. But the most important blessings are those that relate to Judah and Joseph. One, Judah, will carry the scepter, and the other, Joseph, will carry the royal priesthood into the new kingdom. The prospect of this will be a cause for strengthening of Israel when we're at our weakest point, because we're not living by the blessings, because we're not doing the weightier matters of the law. The priesthood of Joseph, by the way, is the Lord's plan A. The Lord always planned to have a royal priesthood that would have priests representatives from all 12 tribes. All 12 tribes were supposed to be a royal priesthood. That's the Lord's plan A. That's the priesthood of Joseph is plan A. The Levite priesthood is the Lord's plan B, or the substitute priesthood. Now, both priesthoods will serve in the kingdom. Joseph will represent what's known as the sons of Zadok, which come from all 12 tribes. And then Levi will serve in the temple there as, you know, Levi, as the Levites. Verse 3, and Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a multitude of people, and I will give this land to your seed after you for an everlasting possession. And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Keep this order in mind, because later on we're going to see that even though Manasseh is the oldest and Ephraim is the youngest, we're going to find out that Ephraim actually takes the place as the firstborn. But this, you know, hasn't happened yet, but it's actually kind of prophetic right here within the Torah portion that Jacob is telling us what he intends to do. He intends to make Ephraim first and Manasseh second, which were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt. These are mine, as Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. And your issue, which you beget after them, shall be yours, and shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance. Okay, so right now he is telling Joseph exactly what he intends to do. He intends to adopt Ephraim and Manasseh. Verse 7, and as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died by me in the land of Canaan in the way when there was but a little way to come to Ephrath, and I buried her there in the way of Ephrath. The same is Bethlehem. Now later on I'm going to do a little bit of word study on this word Ephrath, but for now, just suffice it to say that the name Ephraim is connected with Ephrath, which is where Rachel died. It's kind of significant, actually. And as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died by me in the land of Canaan in the way, when yet there was a little way to come to Ephrath, and I buried her there in the way of Ephrath, the same as Bethlehem. So, Ephraim's name is connected to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. Isn't that interesting? Jacob is strengthening the covenant there with Joseph by repeating a blessing to him. He repeated that God Almighty appeared to him at Luz, and that the Lord had told him that he was going to make him fruitful and multiply him and give the land of Israel to him and to his seed after him for an everlasting possession. So he is strengthening the covenant that the Lord made with him and explaining it to Joseph here. You see, he's repeating it as part of the blessing to Joseph. So we see here the intention for there to be an adoption. And adoptions come with blessings. So here is the first adoption of people who would be considered Gentiles. Ephraim and Manasseh were Gentiles because even though Joseph was Hebrew, their mother was a Gentile. And so they're in that mixed multitude kind of thing where like when they came out of Egypt, they came out as a mixed multitude. These two boys are Erev. They are mixed. So this right here is a prophecy, and it foreshadows the work that is done by our Messiah to bring all peoples, whether they're Hebrews, whether they're purely Gentiles, or whether they're mixed, into his covenant. Anyone who wants to be in the multitude, let me explain what that is. That word multitude there in verse, let me go back here and see which verse it's in. In verse 4, means assembly. It's Strong's 6951. So the work of the Messiah is that anyone who wants to be in the assembly, you see, and to be in the assembly, you have to join the covenant. You have to cross over from the covenant that you were born into with Hasatan and cross over into the covenant by choice, into the covenant with Yehovah. And so this is the work, the prophetic significance of the work of our Messiah. And prophetically, this is important because Ephraim and Manasseh are scattered in the world as the house of Israel, also known as the house of Joseph and the house of Ephraim. And so they're mixed. You see, they're mixed. So the work of the Messiah is now to bring them home. If they had not been adopted by Jacob, they could not rightly take their place in the kingdom. You see, we got named the house of Ephraim or the house of Joseph purposefully, I believe, by the Lord, because it's an indicator of the work of the Messiah of bringing us back. If we're out here in the mixed multitude, then the only way for us to get back is to be adopted back into the covenant. So it is this adoption that's happening right now with Jacob that has allowed Ephraim to actually speak for Jacob, Joseph, and Manasseh throughout time. And Israel beheld Joseph's sons and said, "Who are these?" And Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons, whom God has given me in this place." And he said, "Bring them, I pray you, to me, and I will bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim for age, so that he could not see. And he brought them near to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. Well, before we look at verses 8 and 9, I want to look at verse 10. I want to talk about Israel's eyes being dim. They were dim in the same way that Isaac's eyes were dim when Jacob got the blessing from Isaac, right? This dimness of physical vision is our hint that what these men did next was a spiritual decision in accordance with the will of the Father, you see? And now we're going to go on to read some more before I explain a little bit more about verses 8 and 9. And Israel said to Joseph, I had not thought to see your face, and lo, God has shown me also your seed. And Joseph brought them out from between his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And so these boys by this time were in their 20s, right? They were small children when Jacob came to Egypt, but they probably were maybe, I don't know, under 10, maybe. We don't really know. I guess we could probably go back and, if we really wanted to do the math, find out. But here's the deal. They were not small children where they were standing beside Joseph and hugging onto his knees, you see. They were in their 20s, probably. And yet, this says that Joseph brought them out from between his knees. What does that mean? This is a Hebrew expression of voluntarily presenting the sons to Israel. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in the left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near to him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. So we here see the spiritual significance of Israel's eyes being dim. Because here we see that there's going to be this is another place where the secondborn takes the precedence. And he blessed Joseph and said, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed me all my life long to this day, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and let my name be on them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. I want you to pay attention to here the blessing, because when we come into the covenant, when we are adopted in, who are our forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so we become the seed of Abraham. That's what this is so significant here, is that Jacob was making them the seed of Abraham, or I should say Israel was making them the seed of Abraham. Now, who is this messenger, this angel which redeemed Jacob from all evil? That messenger was the one that he struggled with. Remember the struggle? And that's where the name got changed from Jacob to Israel. And that messenger, as I have taught before, is Yeshua. And so our blessings come from Yeshua. Our salvation comes from Yeshua. Our adoption is because of Yeshua. And when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head onto Manasseh's head. Now, I want you to pay attention to me, because now I'm going to start to explain a little bit about verses 8 and 9, and this will all kind of bring it into focus, I think. If you'll remember that in the past I have taught that Joseph represents Jesus, and of course Jesus is associated with first the Catholic Church and secondarily the Protestant Church, but Joseph represents Christian doctrine, okay? Now, that Christian doctrine was created by the Catholic Church. I mean, it just is a historic fact. So let's just break it down and let Joseph represent the Catholic Church here, okay? And then we'll understand that this also spills over into the Protestant Church. The Catholic Church was created by Edomites. I have talked at length in other Torah portions and in the Esau effect about the creation of the Catholic Church by Edomites, and how that the Jews understand that Rome is nicknamed Basra because it's actually occupied by Esau, by Edomites. Anyway, without going more into that, let's continue. Here's what Edomites believe. Edomites believe in the right of the firstborn. Joseph here is showing that he believes in the right of the firstborn. Joseph representing the Catholic Church, see? The right of the firstborn is the principle that says that that which is done in the physical takes precedence over what is done in the spiritual. And in fact, the Catholic Church and also Orthodox Judaism believe that what they do in the physical takes precedence over what is done in the spiritual. So to this day, Christian doctrine does not understand the spiritual principle of the precedence of the second born over the firstborn. They don't understand how the Lord used the second born as the symbol for that each one of us becomes the firstborn in the kingdom when we are adopted. This is because Edomites are still after the firstborn blessing. The Catholic Church is still after the firstborn blessing. And that is what causes them to be short-sighted about the Torah and about understanding Yeshua's mission. Thus, Joseph, as the Catholic Church, is displeased about the secondborn, Ephraim, getting the blessing over Manasseh, the firstborn. Genesis 48:18. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand upon his head." So, Joseph, as the Edomite church, symbolically, whose deity is Jesus, the one who destroys the law, especially the law of the spiritual firstborn, actually argues with the Father, you see? Esau today is still arguing with Jehovah, right? And trying to prove through warfare that it is the physical firstborn who has the right to the kingdom, not the second firstborn. So in this instance, I am not denigrating Joseph. I'm saying that symbolically he represents a principle that is held to by an entity who came into being after Yeshua resurrected and at the end of days is still holding on to this ideology. Genesis 48:19. And his father refused and said, "I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them that day, saying, In you shall Israel bless, saying, God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And he set Ephraim before Manasseh." The blessing given to the whole house of Israel now is that we should be like Ephraim and Manasseh. As a matter of fact, in some congregations, they sing that song about "May the Lord make you like Ephraim and Manasseh," right? I can't remember the name of the song, but I'm sure you've heard it. Now, what are those blessings? Well, those blessings are found in the names. Let's look at Manasseh. The name is Strong's 45:19, and it literally means causing to forget. And then let's look at the root word of Manasseh, which is Strong's 53:82, and it is Nashah. Nashah is the root, and it means to forget, but it also means to neglect or to remit or remove. See? So Manasseh's name means to neglect, remit, or remove. It's that kind of forgetfulness. It's the kind of forgetfulness that happens when you neglect something and then you no longer care about it. Like when the northern kingdom, the house of Israel, neglected to maintain its Torah. It didn't maintain the Torah correctly, and thus it forgot the Torah. You see what I'm saying? It's that long-term forgetfulness. Now, let's go and look at the name Ephraim. Remember earlier I said that Ephraim is connected to Ephrath, and Ephrath is where Rachel is buried. And this kind of puts Rachel in the place of the firstborn mother. You see, I've never really understood how it was that even the Jews refer to Rachel as being the first mother of the tribes. And now I do, because I did this word study. Ephraim is Strong 669, and it means double fruit, okay? It's Ephraim's name. It means double fruit. So this is why he's doubly blessed. And you suppose that that Joseph knew that Ephraim meant that, double fruit? Well, probably, but I doubt that he knew what the prophetic significance of it. But the root of 669 is 672, which is Ephrath, which means fruitfulness. Ephrath has to do with fruitfulness. And where Rachel was buried has to do with fruitfulness. And it's also Bethlehem, in the territory of her descendants, you see, in the house of Israel. Do you see how all that plays out prophetically, and how that makes her actually the primary mother? We say that Rachel cries for her children. Well, we understand that she's crying for all 12 tribes, yet she did not give birth to all 12 tribes. Yet because of Ephraim's adoption and the blessings that he got, and because of what his name means and how it's connected to where she's buried, now she is lifted up to a place where we can say Rachel is crying for her children, meaning all of Israel. Does that make sense? Moving on, the blessing to Ephraim is very much like the blessing given by Isaac to Jacob. The difference is that in this case, Manasseh did not complain like Esau did. So there is no prophecy here about Manasseh breaking free of Ephraim, as there is with Esau having to break away from Jacob. Now, I want to go back to verses 8 and 9 and ask this question. Why did Israel say, "Who are these?" when surely he knew who they were? Well, it's because we're witnessing a legal proceeding. When you go to a court and you have to testify, you have to declare who you are. Now, when there's an adoption and what the parent appears and the adoptive parent appears, there has to be a legal passing of the child from the biological parent to the adoptive parent. So the court has to identify who all these people are. So who are these is the children. They have to be identified in the process, because let me tell you what this means. When we're adopted, the Lord knows us. He knows each one of our names. He has a personal relationship with us. And that's what's happening here. Israel is getting a personal relationship with Ephraim and Manasseh. This is also the same kind of thing as when you get married. See, the father is asked by the preacher, who gives this woman, he doesn't really name her at that point, who gives this woman, who is she? The father gives the woman to the man, right? And so you have the same kind of, it's very similar. That's why being adopted is very much like getting married. We say that we are married to Yeshua, or are going to be married to Yeshua. And at the same time, we also understand that we're adopted. But the proceeding is the same. You see, how you get adopted and how you get married are pretty much the same thing. So this ceremony was a legal transaction, and this legal transaction was being conducted in front of the whole family. And in fact, I personally believe that all of the people in the family, not just the other 12 brothers, were present. And the reason for that is going to be very evident in some of my next comments, because this ceremony also served to keep the brothers quiet about it. Now, it kept them quiet at that point and made them aware that these sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were as Reuben and Simeon, meaning that Jacob put them in the place of Reuben and Simeon. So in Jacob's mind, in the genealogy, Ephraim and Manasseh come first. And so the brothers had to be made aware of that. And also, it's a way to keep the brothers quiet in the kingdom, you see. According to the ancient Near East covenant model, the patriarch could appoint anyone in his family to have the firstborn place. And the one that was appointed to be in the firstborn place had to be part of the patriarch's family. He had to be a son. He could not be a grandson. He couldn't be a nephew or a cousin. He had to be a son. This is why Jacob had to adopt Joseph's boys, and he put them in the place of Reuben and Simeon. But in the kingdom to come, there could still be a problem. Let's say that Jacob had not done this thing in a legal way. Well, let's step back a minute and understand that the Lord does everything in a legal way. Everything happening now and that will happen in the Great Tribulation has to do with the covenant lawsuit. A lawsuit has a legal precedent to it. You can't bring a lawsuit unless there's some legal basis for it. So let's say that Jacob hadn't done this legally. Let's just say that he had said, oh, I'm just going to bring them into the family and you know, they'll be just like Reuben and Simeon. No. If he had said that, in the coming kingdom, there would be a problem. Because remember, Joseph will have precedence in the kingdom. Judah will have lost the scepter. Yet Joseph will be the progenitor of the sons of Zadok. Joseph will be the one that has carried plan A. Well, all the other brothers would be able to say, hey, this is not legal. So there would be possibly a lawsuit of the other brothers in the kingdom in order to get Reuben's and Simeon's place back. And so then plan A would fall under the name of Reuben instead of Joseph. Are you following the logic there? If Jacob had not made Ephraim's blessing legal, then all of the older brothers would make a claim and argue that they deserved the firstborn blessing. And listen, Reuben would make that claim because he would say, well, I am the firstborn. And Judah might say something like, well, the scepter was his until the Messiah came to claim it. But, I mean, you know, he had gotten the firstborn blessing because Reuben failed and then Simeon failed and then Levi failed. Yet Levi would claim that he should be given the firstborn place because he had been given the priesthood. And thus, you know, there would be no need for two priesthoods in the kingdom. Levi could just be firstborn. And Simeon would claim that he had been the best protector of the family because he killed all those men at Shechem defending Dinah. And since he was second in line and Reuben had defiled Jacob's concubine, the firstborn blessing should actually fall to him. And you see, it could just go on and on. Every one of those other 12 brethren would have a reason to say, no, I should be the one to have the firstborn blessing. So this legal thing that happened here protected Ephraim and Manasseh from that point forward all the way through eternity. You getting my drift? There is no one who will be able to bring a lawsuit. There is no legal precedent for anyone to be able to say that Ephraim did not deserve the firstborn blessing. And, in fact, this is why it is that an adopted son cannot be unadopted. No one can ever take away Ephraim's place, and no one can ever take away your place as the firstborn. No one can ever take away my place as the firstborn. The gift once given cannot be taken away. Now, if, in the absence of this legal adoption, any of Jacob's other sons were able to make claim to the firstborn, or to the firstborn blessing, then the whole redemption plan for the house of Israel would have been undone. That's another reason why this had to be done legally. Everything that the Lord planned for the house of Israel would have been undone if later on people could come forward and make some kind of legal claim before the Lord. You see, this is very important. It's very important to understand the legality of the Torah and to understand the legality of the procedures of the adoption and the procedures of the sacrifices and the procedures of following the Torah and understanding about not committing crimes against the Torah, because that is legal stuff you're dealing with. And then why was the firstborn blessing not reaffirmed back to Joseph? Well, because Joseph had been adopted by Pharaoh. He was no longer Israel's son. You see, and that's another allusion to a church that is still in Egypt, is still in the world, metaphorically and spiritually. You see what I'm saying? So it falls to Ephraim and Manasseh to fulfill the role of what Joseph would have fulfilled if he had not already had a legal duty to Pharaoh as Pharaoh's son. Now, let me explain that Ephraim and Manasseh are Joseph's double portion manifested on the earth. Joseph actually did become the one first in line. Now, why do I say that? Why do I say that Ephraim and Manasseh are the representatives of Joseph on the earth? Well, because in the New Jerusalem, there's no gate that's going to say Ephraim or Manasseh. The gate is going to say Joseph. But for legal reasons and for prophetic reasons, it was done this way, in order to make sure that Joseph really gets the glory that's due him as one representing Yeshua. Jacob made sure that Joseph's double portion as the firstborn was readily visible for everyone to see forever through Ephraim and Manasseh. I hope that makes sense. And the fact that Jacob gave Ephraim and Manasseh all of Joseph's authority in the family is a prophecy about the authority that Christianity would have in the world. See, Christianity, like Joseph at that time, is pagan. But that is where Ephraim and Manasseh are as well, are we not? As the other brothers who are not Jews at this time. We're not Jews, but we're scattered in the house of Israel. And so we are scattered into the pagan world. Ephraim got the authority to lead the entire house of Israel into paganism. Ephraim was born in a pagan land and led the house of Israel back into paganism. And this all has to be set straight in the kingdom when Yeshua adopts us and gives us names. And yes, even though we're adopted now, we will not get our adoptive names until we get into the kingdom. You know, in Revelation, it talks about him giving us a new name. And so you can see that the significance of this adoption of Ephraim and Manasseh has deep and far-reaching consequences, some of which boggles even my mind to try to understand how it all works. I'm still working on it. So, the fact that Jacob gave Ephraim and Manasseh all of Joseph's authority in the family is, as I said before, a prophecy about the authority that Christianity would one day have in the world. I really believe that it is prophetic about Christianity in the world. Now let's move on and go to verse 28. And Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I die, but God shall be with you and bring you again to the land of your fathers." This is a prophecy that has occurred in the past and will occur again in the future. Remember, Jacob's bones were taken into the land, and Joseph's bones were too. And the whole house of Israel then went into the land at the time of Joshua. And they were in the land until 722 BC. So here where it says, "And that he will bring you again to the land of your fathers," That's already happened once. That's in the past. But now we're living here at the end of days when the whole house of Israel is going to be able to be in the land. Genesis 48:22. Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. Now here is another area where we don't have all the details. In Genesis, there is no battle between Jacob and the Amorites. There is no mention of Jacob taking the Amorites with his sword and with his bow. So, where do we have to go for information? Well, before I tell you all of that, I want to explain what the word Shechem means. Jacob was in Shechem, and Shechem is Strong's 7926, and it means the neck as the place of, you know, that holds the head, a place of burdens, it says. And so Shechem is the neck. And then we have 7927, which is Shechem, which means ridge, and it also is a place in Israel. It says Palestine here in Esau, but I'm calling it Israel. The ridge was Jacob's portion. It represented his hold on the area that Jehovah described and gave to Abraham. Strong 7928 lists Shechem as the name of a Hivite and two Israelites. So Jacob's portion, his Shechem, was inhabited by Gentiles. Now, I bring all that up because there's a prophecy here in verse 48:22, and it's a prophecy that we don't find the details of in Genesis. But in order for us to understand the significance of the battle that they fought over Shechem that doesn't appear in Genesis, we need to know that Shechem is Jacob's portion in the land. His little plot there where he was trying to hold on to his inheritance, even though he was surrounded like Israel is today. The prophecies regarding Shechem are a little bit mystifying to us because of the lack of information in Genesis. So here's the deal. Events at Shechem represent future prophecy. And we don't ever really get a full explanation of that. We just hear teachers and other commentators talk about how Shechem and the events that happened at Shechem play into future prophecy, but yet we don't see that in Genesis. And Christian commentators just try to make that verse 22 to be just allegorical. You know, they just don't have all the information, so they just say it's an allegory. It was just a saying that, you know, Jacob went there and he bought the land. But buying land doesn't mean you took it by sword and bow. Buying land and going to war over it are two different things. So where do all the prophecies that people talk about and that they insist that Shechem is prophetic, where does all that come from? Well, it comes from chapter 37 in the book of Jasher. I am going to read this chapter to you and comment on it as we go. In the 105th year of the life of Jacob, that is, the ninth year of Jacob's dwelling with his children in the land of Canaan, he came from Paddan Aram. And in those days, Jacob journeyed with his children from Hebron, and they went and returned to the city of Shechem, they and all belonging to them, and they dwelt there. For the children of Jacob obtained good and fat pasture for their cattle in the city of Shechem having been rebuilt, and there were in it about 300 men and women. And Jacob and his children and all belonging to him dwelt in the part of the field which Jacob had bought from Hamor, the father of Shechem, when he came from Paddan Aram before Simeon and Levi had smitten the city. And all those kings of the Canaanites and Amorites that surrounded the city of Shechem heard that the sons of Jacob had come again to Shechem and dwelt there. Okay, prophetically, We have Israel had gone into the land, and then at 722, they started to, 722 BC, they started to be taken into captivity. The house of Israel went into captivity, and then the house of Judah went into captivity, right? They came back, the Jews came back from Babylon, and then, they went into captivity again when the Romans sacked Jerusalem and kicked all the Jews out of the land. Okay, so now, here we are up at 1948. They're back in the land, you see. They're back in Shechem, prophetically. And they said, shall the sons of Jacob the Hebrew again come to the city and dwell therein after that we've smitten, after they have smitten its inhabitants and driven them out? Shall they now return and also drive out those who are willing, who are dwelling in the city, or slay them? And all the kings of Canaan again assembled, and they came together to make war with Jacob and his sons. You see, the surrounding countries around Israel intend to drive the Jews out of Israel. And Jashub, king of Tapnach, sent also to all his neighboring kings, to Elon, king of Gosh, and to Ehuri, king of Shiloh, and to Parathon, king of Khazar, and to Susi, king of Sartan, and to Laban, king of Bethkoron, and to Shabir, king of Ophnemah, saying, come up to me and assist me, and let us smite Jacob the Hebrew and his sons and all belonging to him, for they are again come to Shechem to possess it and to slay its inhabitants as before. And all these kings assembled together and came with all their camps, a people exceedingly plentiful, like the sand upon the seashore, and they were all opposed to Tapnach. Okay. The kings assembled together and came with all their camps and were like sand upon the seashore. That means there was a lot of them. And Jashub, king of Tapnach, went forth to them with all his army, and he encamped with them opposite to Tapnach without the city, and all those kings divided into seven divisions, being seven camps against the sons of Jacob. And they sent a declaration to Jacob and his son, saying, come you all forth to us, that we may have an interview together in the plain, and revenge the cause of the men of Shechem, whom you slew in your city, and you will now again return to the city of Shechem, and dwell therein, and slay its inhabitants as before. Now, of course, you know that Jacob said to his sons, Simeon and Levi, after they slew the men of Shechem, that surely these people are going to come to war with us. And I think probably that's why they went to Hebron, and now they're back, and their enemies want to have an interview with them. What does that word interview mean? Well, I don't have a Hebrew, interlinear Bible or anything to go by to what that Hebrew word there for interview, the way it was translated. I don't know what that means necessarily, but it sounds like they're saying, come on over here. We just want to talk. Okay, so now we see how that is prophetic for what's going on in Israel now. All that talking going on. And the sons of Jacob heard this, and their anger was kindled exceedingly at the words of the kings of Canaan. And 10 of the sons of Jacob hastened and rose up, and each of them girt his weapons of war. And there were 102 of their servants with them, equipped in battle array. Well, first of all, just that one guy, Tapnach, had a army so plentiful it was like the sand upon the seashore. And then the other thing is, here we have 10 of the brothers rising up. Does that bring any memory or ring a bell in any way? 10. Why 10? Well, because at this time, Joseph and Benjamin were still children. You see, this is way back when they first got back to the land from Laban's area, remember? And so Joseph and Benjamin were not old enough to go fight the battle. So it was 10 brethren who took up the battle. And all these men, the sons of Jacob, with their servants, went toward these kings, and Jacob their father was with them. So you have just several hundred people here 102, I'm not even several hundred, you have 102 of their servants and 11 men with them, Jacob and his 10 sons. And so now what is that? 102 plus 11 is 113 people against all these great armies around them. And they all stood upon the heap of Shechem. And Jacob prayed to the Lord for his sons, and he spread forth his hands to the Lord and said, O God, you are a mighty God. You are almighty God. You are our Father. You did form us, and we are the work of your hands. I pray you, deliver my sons through your mercy from the hand of their enemies, who are this day coming to fight with them, and save them from their hand. For in your hand is power and might to save the few from the many. And give to my sons, your servants, strength of heart and might to fight with their enemies, to subdue them and make their enemies fall before them. And let not my sons and your servants die by the hands of the children of Canaan. But if it seems good in your eyes to take away the lives of my sons and their servants, take them in your great mercy through the hands of your ministers, that they may not perish this day by the hands of the kings of the Amorites. See, he's fighting here, Amorites. And when Jacob ceased praying to the Lord, the earth shook from its place, and the sun darkened. And all these kings were terrified, and a great consternation seized them. Look, here we have scenes from the Great Tribulation. We have scenes from the prophets. And at the end of days, the earth is going to shake and the sun is going to be darkened. Remember? So this is similar to what is going to happen at the end of days. And the Lord hearkened to the prayer of Jacob, and the Lord impressed the hearts of all the kings and their hosts with terror and awe of the sons of Jacob. Now, the writer of Jasher does not make the same distinction between Jacob, the man of history, and Israel, the man of prophecy, that Moses did when he wrote the book of Genesis. But it will be, in the end of days, Israel who prays, and the Lord will cause their enemies to be afraid. For the Lord caused them to hear the voice of chariots and the voice of mighty horses from the sons of Jacob, and the voice of a great army accompanying them. And these kings were seized with great terror at the... Before I get into this next verse, see, the Lord caused those kings to hear and see more things than there actually were there. Now... See, that's just like the Lord. You know, he, believe it or not, there's going to be few of us in the Great Tribulation, but he's going to cause our enemies to think that there's a milieu of us, you see? And these kings were seized with great terror at the sons of Jacob. And while they were standing in their quarters, behold, the sons of Jacob advanced upon them with 112 men with a great and tremendous shouting. I love this story. And when the kings saw the sons of Jacob advancing toward them, they were still more panic-struck. And they were inclined to retreat from before the sons of Jacob as at first, and not to fight with them. But they did not retreat, saying, it would be a disgrace to us thus twice to retreat from before the Hebrews. See, there are scriptures throughout the Bible that refer to the terror that the Hebrews strike and will strike in the hearts of men. Such as, you know, let's just take a look at the book of Obadiah, for instance. How the Edomites are going to be struck with terror because of the Hebrews. Anyway, and the sons of Jacob came near and advanced against all these kings and their armies, and they saw, and behold, it was a very mighty people, numerous as the sand of the sea. And the sons of Jacob called to the Lord and said, help us, O Lord, help us, and answer us, for we trust in you. And let us not die by the hands of these uncircumcised men who this day have come against us. Now listen, this is the cry that we're going to be making in the end of days. We're going to be saying, we trust in you. Let us not die by the hands of these uncircumcised men. What are they asking there? What are they saying there? They are drawing the Lord's attention to the fact that they are circumcised and in the covenant, and that circumcision is a seal, you see? And once you're sealed by the king, he is duty-bound to you. And the sons of Jacob girt on their weapons of war, and they took in their hands each man his shield and his javelin, and they approached to battle. And Judah, the son of Jacob, ran first before his brethren, and 10 of his servants with him, and he went toward these kings. You remember in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 37, it talks about the house of Judah and those who are with him, okay? They go first to battle. And Jashub, king of Tapnach, also came forth first with his army before Judah. And Judah saw Jashub and his army coming toward him, and Judah's wrath was kindled. I don't really think you want to tick off the lion. And his anger burned within him, and he approached to battle, in which Judah ventured his life. And Jashub and all his army were advancing toward Judah, and he was riding upon a very strong and powerful horse, and Jashub was a very valiant man, and covered with iron and brass from head to foot. And while he was upon his horse, he shot arrows with both hands from before and behind, as with his manner in all his battles, and he never missed the place to which he aimed his arrows. And Jashub came to fight with Judah, and was darting many arrows against Judah, and the Lord bound the hand of Jashub, and all the arrows that he shot rebounded upon his own men. You see the hand of the Lord there, the hand of Jehovah? And notwithstanding this, Jashub kept advancing toward Judah to challenge him with the arrows, but the distance between them was about 30 cubits. And when Judah saw Jashub darting forth his arrows against him, he ran to him with his wrath-excited might. And Judah took up a large stone from the ground, and its weight was 60 shekels. And Judah ran toward Jashub, and with the stone struck him on his shield, that Jashub was stunned from the blow and fell off his horse to the ground. And the shield burst asunder out of the hand of Jashub, and through the force of the blow sprang to the distance of about 15 cubits. And the shield fell before the second camp. And the kings that came with Jashub saw at a distance the strength of Judah, the son of Jacob, and what he had done to Jashub. They were terribly afraid of Judah. And they assembled near Jashub's camp, seeing his confusion. And Judah drew his sword and smote 42 men of the camp of Jashub, and the whole of Jashub's camp fled before Judah, and no man stood up against him. And they left Jashub and fled from him, and Jashub was still prostrate upon the ground. And Jashub, seeing that all the men of his camp had fled from him, hastened and rose up with terror against Judah and stood upon his legs opposite Judah. And Jashub had a single combat with Judah, placing shield toward shield, and Jashub's men all fled, for they were greatly afraid of Judah. And Jashub took his spear in his hand to strike Judah upon his head, but Judah had quickly placed his shield to his head against Jashub's spear, so that the shield of Judah received the blow from Jashub's spear, and the shield was split in two. And when Judah saw that his shield was split, he hastily drew his sword and smote Jashub at his ankles and cut off his feet, that Jashub fell upon the ground, and the spear fell from his hand. And Judah hastily picked up Jashub's spear, with which he severed his head, and cast it next to his feet. And when the sons of Jacob saw what Judah had done to Jashub, they all ran into the ranks of the other kings. And the sons of Jacob fought with the army of Jashub and the armies of all the kings that were there. And the sons of Jacob caused 15,000 of their men to fall, and they smote them as if smiting at gourds, and the rest fled for their lives. Now let's think about this. There were 112 of them fighting. Jacob being there was 113. What does this say about how the Lord protects us in battles? Let me go over to Deuteronomy chapter 28, start at verse 1. And it shall come to pass, if you shall hearken diligently to the voice of the Lord your God, to observe and to do all his commandments which I command you this day, that the Lord your God will set you on high above all nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come on you and overtake you, and if you shall hearken to the voice of the Lord your God. Verse 7. The Lord shall cause your enemies that rise up against you to be smitten before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. So from this battle in the book of Jasher, we learn that they must have been keeping the Torah because the Lord made their enemies to flee from before them. And then now moving on with the verse 43 in the chapter 37 of Jasher, it says, And Judah was still standing by the body of Jashub and stripped Jashub of his coat of mail. And Judah also took off the iron and brass that was about Jashub, and behold, nine men of the captains of Jashub came along to fight against Judah. And Judah hastened and took up a stone from the ground and with it smote one of them upon the head, and his skull was fractured, and the body also fell from the horse to the ground. And the eight captains that remained, seeing the strength of Judah, were greatly afraid, and they fled. And Judah with his ten men pursued them, and they overtook them and slew them. The sons of Jacob were still smiting the armies of the kings, and they slew many of them. But these kings daringly kept their stand with their captains, and did not retreat from their places. And they exclaimed against those of their army that fled from before the sons of Jacob, but none would listen to them, for they were afraid of their lives, lest they should die. And all the sons of Jacob, after having smitten the armies of the kings, returned and came before Judah. And Judah was still slaying the eight captains of Jashub and stripping off their garments. And Levi saw Elon, the king of Gash, advancing toward him with his 14 captains to smite him. But Levi did not know it for certain. And Elon with his captains approached nearer, and Levi looked back and saw that battle was given him in the rear. And Levi ran with 12 of his servants, and they went and slew Elon and his captains with the edge of the sword. Now, there are more exploits of the sons of Jacob in chapters 38 through 40. And so I'm not going to continue reading there. I want you, though, to understand that we're being given a picture of the fierceness of the Great Tribulation. The Bible says that the Great Tribulation will see trouble like no other time on earth. And if you have listened carefully to what was going on here in this battle, it was a mess. There was chaos everywhere. That is a description of the Great Tribulation. Now, that what I just read to you is the answer in verse 22 of chapter 48. Okay, 48:22 says that Jacob said that he had taken something from the Amorite with sword and bow. Okay, and now you know what that's referring to. And now let's return to the book of Genesis, chapter 49, verse 1. And Jacob called to his sons and said, Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which will befall you in the last days. You see, right after he has talked to Joseph about the battle with the Amorites over Shechem, now he's going to tell them what befell them, what will befall them in the last days. Gather yourselves together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and hearken to Israel your father. Israel, not, he says, sons of Jacob, and hearken to Israel your father. See, he's already telling them they are a nation of Israelites. Reuben, you're my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, unstable as water. You shall not excel because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. See, what this is talking about here is he's giving Reuben the reason why he put Ephraim in Reuben's place. That's what it means when it says, you shall not excel. You're not going to be the firstborn. Simeon and Levi are brethren, instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. O my soul, come not you into their secret, into their assembly, my honor. Be not you united, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they digged down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. You know, this makes me wonder. There are so many people in the Hebrew roots community say, oh, I think I'm from the tribe of Levi. Well, we have a lot of cruelty in the Hebrew roots community at times, and I wonder just how many of those people are telling the truth, especially if they happen to be cruel people. Judah, you are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Actually, that's happening right now. Judah is out front, and we in the house of Israel are bowing to him. See, we wrongly think that Judah does not have any say in the house of Israel, but we're wrong. He is keeping us from making aliyah, is he not? That's one way that we're having to bow to Judah. As long as we refuse to recognize Judah's authority with the scepter, he will continue to deny us access to the land. And that is until he needs us to be with him in great numbers in order to help defeat his enemies. There's coming a time when the Samaria and the West Bank and that area is going to need to have inhabitants. Israel will go to war against the Palestinians. And the book of Zechariah talks about how the Jews are just going to mow those people down. Well, but legally, if you want to hang on to a land, and militarily, if you want to hang on to a land, you got to have inhabitants. And so, at some point, he's going to need us. Judah is going to need to open up the land to Aliyah for people who believe in the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so there is coming a time when he will, out of necessity, have to let us make Aliyah. But the truth of the matter is, getting back to the original point, Judah does have the scepter. And Judah having the scepter does affect the house of Israel. Verse 9, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you are gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. So when Shiloh comes, or the Messiah comes, then the people will be gathered to the Messiah. Just remember that Judah still holds the scepter. Verse 11, binding his foal to the vine, and his ass's colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk. Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall be for an haven of ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon. And Issachar is a strong ass, couching down between two burdens. And he saw that rest was good, and the land that it was pleasant, and bowed his shoulder to bear, and became a servant unto tribute. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. That's interesting. Jacob used a new term there in verse 16, calling them the tribes of Israel. Yet it hasn't been until the Hebrew roots community arose in the past few decades that there has been any talk of tribes taking place. Now, earlier in Scripture, as the children of Israel were coming out of Egypt and going into the land, they became known as the tribes of Israel. But you see here in this passage, Genesis 49, we're learning about what's going to happen at the end of days. You see? And so this phrase, tribes of Israel, this is the first place that this has been used. This phrase has never been used in Scripture before now. And it's referring to the end of days. And so it's referring to our awakening about our tribal origins, you see. It is an end time prophecy from Jacob. Verse 17, Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that bites the horse heels so that his rider shall fall backward. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. Gad, a troop, shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. Out of Asher his bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties. Naphtali is a hind let loose. He gives goodly words. Joseph is a fruitful Ephratah bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. And the archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. But his bough abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hand of the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Let's stop here. Because this word fruitful has come up again in relation Joseph. That word there, fruitful, is actually it's para. It's Strong's 6509, but it's related to Ephrath, fruitful, and Ephraim, double fruit. And it's interesting that we get down here to the verse 24 where it says, from thence a shepherd, who's the shepherd? The Messiah, and the stone of Israel. Who is the stone of Israel? The Messiah. So the Messiah is related also to Joseph. Even though the Messiah came through the line of Judah, the fruit of Messiah, see, the fruit of Messiah comes through Joseph. This is what I keep telling everybody in my Torah portions. We, in the Hebrew Roots community, are not nearly as fruitful as we might think. Actually, Christians are quite a bit more fruitful than we are. They're bearing children. You know, people are getting saved. I don't like that term, getting saved, but, you know, they're coming forth to Messiah, probably is a better way to put it. And they practice the weightier matters of the law. A lot better than we do. So the fruitfulness of the Messiah comes through Joseph. Verse 25, even by the God of your father who shall help you, and by the Almighty who shall bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie underneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. By the way, what he just said there are the same elements that Jacob got from Isaac. In Genesis 27:28, it says, therefore, God give you the dew of the heaven and the fatness of the earth, and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brethren, and let my mother's, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be every one that curses you, and blessed be he that blesses you. You see, dew of heaven, blessings of heaven. Fatness of the earth, blessings of the deep that lie under, blessing of the breast and of the womb. You see, it's all the same kind of blessings. Verse 26, the blessings of your father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that was separate from his brethren. Joseph is known from being separate from his brethren, Judah. Remember? Here we see that Jacob passed the blessing that he got from Isaac, and he added more blessings on top of that. So Joseph still holds the blessings, but his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, are the visible evidence of them on earth today. Verse 27, Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is it that their father spoke to them and blessed them. Every one according to his blessing he blessed them. And he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, and in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite for a possession of a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife, and there I buried Leah. The purchase of the field and of the cave that is therein was from the children of Heth. And when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost and was gathered to his people. And I don't know why it is, every time I read about the death of one of our patriarchs, I just get so sad, and I just hang on to the belief that I am going to meet them in the kingdom. I have such high regard for these men and how they obeyed the Lord. But I want to share something else with you from the book of Jasher. This is chapter 56, and it explains, it gives us more detail about the honor that was bestowed on Jacob and how that he was so well loved. He was, in his death, was treated like a king. Starting at chapter 56 in the book of Jasher and verse 23, it says, "And Joseph fell upon his father, and he cried out and wept over him and kissed him. And he called out in a bitter voice, and he said, O my father, my father." Verse 27. "And also all the people of Egypt who knew Jacob came all on that day when they heard this thing, and all Egypt wept for many days. And it came to pass that Joseph commanded his servants, the doctors, to embalm his father with myrrh and frankincense and all the manner of incense and perfume. And the doctors embalmed Jacob as Joseph had commanded them." Now, I have heard people say that Joseph should not have embalmed Jacob, but let me explain something to you. They were going to take him from Egypt all the way up into the cave of Machpelah, and it was going to take quite some time for that to happen. And so it was better for Jacob to have been embalmed than for him to have been a bloating corpse, you know, with all the nastiness that goes with that as they traveled up to the cave of Machpelah. Verse 30, "And all the people of Egypt and the elders and all the inhabitants of the land of Goshen wept and mourned over Jacob. And all his sons and the children of his household lamented and mourned over their father Jacob many days. And after the days of his weeping had passed away, at the end of 70 days, Joseph said to Pharaoh, I will go up and bury my father in the land of Canaan as he made me swear, and then I will return." The significance of 70 days, there may be a lot more significance than what I'll bring up here, but I believe 70 days was pretty close to the number of days that it took to embalm a body. "And Pharaoh sent Joseph, saying, Go up and bury your father. And Pharaoh commanded that it should be proclaimed throughout Egypt, saying, Whoever goes not up with Joseph and his brethren to the land of Canaan to bury Jacob shall die." Look, Pharaoh commanded that they go to bury Jacob, that they go with Joseph. "And all Egypt heard of Pharaoh's proclamation, and they all rose up together, and all the servants of Pharaoh and the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt went up with Joseph, and all the officers and nobles of Pharaoh went up as the servants of Joseph, and they went to bury Jacob in the land of Canaan. The sons of Jacob carried the bier upon which he lay, according to all that their father commanded them, so did his sons to him. And the bier was of pure gold, and it was inlaid round about with onyx stones and delium, and the covering of the bier was gold-woven work, joined with threads, and over them were hooks of onyx stones and bdellium. And Joseph placed upon the head of his father Jacob a large golden crown, and he put a golden scepter in his hand, and they surrounded the bier, as was the custom of kings during their lives." So they treated Jacob as the king of Israel here, see? And I know some people don't like the book of Jasher, and they say, well, you know, they don't know that it was, it's actually accurate and all that stuff. But look, the book has been quoted in other places in the Bible, and I'm not going to go into that right now. This is just so beautiful, and I think we need to get this detail. Verse 38, "And all the troops of Egypt went before him in this array, at first all the mighty men of Pharaoh and the mighty men of Joseph, and after them the rest of the inhabitants of Egypt, and they were all girded with swords and equipped with coats of mail, and the trappings of war were upon them. And all the weepers and mourners went at a distance opposite to the bier, going and weeping and lamenting, and the rest of the people went after the bier. And Joseph and his household went together near the bier, barefooted and weeping, and the rest of Joseph's servants went around him. Each man had his ornaments upon him, and they were all armed with their weapons of war." Now, I want to say something about the weeping of Joseph. In the book of Jasher, we get the details of what happened to Joseph when he got thrown into the pit and taken into Egypt, and how he threw himself on his mother's grave and wept. I keep saying that Joseph is a type and shadow of the Christian church. I have never seen people more willing to weep than Christians, and even Christian men, which I think is a great strength in a man to be able to shed tears. I just see that so clearly in them and in Joseph. Anyway. And 50 of Jacob's servants went in front of the buyer, and they strewed along the road, myrrh and aloes, and all manner of perfume, and all the sons of Jacob that carried the buyer walked upon the perfumery. And the servants of Jacob went before them, strewing the perfume along the road. And Joseph went up with a heavy camp, and they did after this manner every day until they reached the land of Canaan. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which was on the other side of Jordan, and they mourned an exceeding great and heavy mourning in that place. And all the kings of Canaan heard of this, and they all went forth, each man from his house, 31 kings of Canaan. And they all came with their men to mourn and weep over Jacob. Now, among these kings might have been some of those that went to war against Jacob. And all these kings beheld Jacob's bier, and behold, Joseph's crown was upon it. And they also put their crowns upon the bier and encircled it with crowns. Tell me that the book of Jasher does not go along the same lines as other scriptures. We will put our crowns, we will throw our crowns at Yeshua's feet, will we not? Jacob as a type and shadow of Yeshua. Now, of course, Jacob being dead is not a type and shadow of Yeshua, but I'm talking about just the crown and what we will do with our crowns. And all these kings made in that place a great and heavy mourning, and the sons of Jacob and Egypt over Jacob, for all the kings of Canaan knew the valor of Jacob and his sons. And the report reached Esau. Now here we're going to find out how Esau dies. Remember, Esau is going to be killed by the house of Judah and the house of Israel that have come together, and they're going to kill the Edomites in the end of days. So now listen to this. And the report reached Esau, saying, Jacob died in Egypt, and his sons and all of Egypt are conveying him to the land of Canaan to bury him. And Esau heard this thing, and he was dwelling in Mount Seir, and he rose up with his sons and all his people and all his household, a people exceedingly great, and they came to mourn and weep over Jacob. And it came to pass, when Esau came, he mourned for his brother Jacob, and all Egypt and all Canaan again rose up and mourned a great mourning with Esau over Jacob in that place. And Joseph and his brethren brought their father Jacob from that place, and they went to Hebron to bury Jacob in the cave of his fathers. And they came to Kiriath Arba, to the cave, and as they came, Esau stood with his sons against Joseph and his brethren as a hindrance in the cave, saying, Jacob shall not be buried therein, for it belongs to us and to our father. Okay, so Esau here is taking his place as the firstborn, saying, I'm the firstborn, you're not, I'm going to be buried in that cave, you're not. It's the same argument that the Palestinians make today when they say that, the Jews don't have the right to the cave of the patriarchs, you see. So here we're getting Esau's attitude. Oh, yeah, he was just crying over his brother having died, but you're not going to put him in that cave. Why? Because that would mean that what the Lord said is true, that Jacob is the firstborn of the family, you see, that Jacob gets the blessing and Jacob gets the birthright. Part of that blessing and birthright is to be able to be buried in the cave with the patriarchs. And Joseph and his brethren heard the words of Esau's sons, and they were exceedingly wroth. And Joseph approached to Esau, saying, What is this thing which they have spoken? Surely my father Jacob bought it from you for great riches after the death of Isaac, now 25 years ago, and also all the land of Canaan he bought from you and from your sons and your seed after you. And Jacob bought it for his sons and his seed after him for an inheritance forever. So why speak you these things this day? And Esau answered, saying, You speak falsely and utter lies, for I sold not anything belonging to me in all this land, as you say, neither did my brother Jacob buy anything belonging to me in this land. And Esau spoke these things in order to deceive Joseph with his words, for Esau knew that Joseph was not present in those days when Esau sold all belonging to him in the land of Canaan to Jacob. Now, the exchange, the sale of, you know, when Jacob bought the land of Canaan, is not listed in the book of Genesis. You'll note that when Jacob went back into the land, he bowed down to Esau 7 times and made Esau really the king of the land. And so, in order to get the land back, Jacob had to pay a price. And he bought the land according to the book of Jasher. And Joseph said to Esau, Surely my father inserted these things with you in the record of purchase and testified the record with witnesses, and behold, it is with us in Egypt. And Esau answered, saying to him, Bring the record, all that you will find in the record, so will we do. And Joseph called to Naphtali his brother and said, Hasten quickly, stay not, and run, I pray you, to Egypt and bring all the records, the record of the purchase, the sealed record, and the open record, and also all the first records in which all the transactions of the birthright are written. Go fetch it. And you shall bring them to us here, that we may know from them all the words of Esau and his sons which they spoke this day. And Naphtali hearkened to the voice of Joseph, and he hastened and ran to go down to Egypt. And Naphtali was lighter on foot than any of the stags that were upon the wilderness, for he would go upon ears of corn without crushing them. When Esau saw that Naphtali had gone to fetch the records, he and his sons increased their resistance against the cave, and Esau and all his people rose up against Joseph and his brethren to battle. You see, this is what the Palestinians do. They know that there are legal records that we in the West don't recognize, and we don't understand the legality of the ancient Near East covenants, but the Middle Eastern people do. And they know, even to this day, that those records exist. They know that Abraham bought the field in the cave at Machpelah. They know that Jacob purchased these things. And what they're doing today is rising up against the Jews, you know, to keep them out of the cave of the patriarchs. And all the sons of Jacob and the people of Egypt fought with Esau and his men, and the sons of Esau and his people were smitten before the sons of Jacob, and the sons of Jacob slew of Esau's people 40 men. And Cushim, the son of Dan, the son of Jacob, was at that time with Jacob's sons, but he was about 100 cubits distant from the place of battle, for he remained with the children of Jacob's sons by Jacob's byre to guard it. And Cushim was dumb and deaf. Still, he understood the voice of consternation against men. And he asked, saying, Why do you not bury the dead? And what is this great consternation? And they answered him with the words of Esau and his sons. And he, that's Cushim, ran to Esau in the midst of the battle. And he slew Esau with a sword, and he cut off his head. And it sprang to a distance, and Esau fell among the people of the battle. Now, you'll recall that Esau decapitated Nimrod. But here we see even greater strength from one of the sons of Israel, as I will call them. Cushim, the grandson of Jacob, one of the tribes of Israel. Cushim was the son of Dan, and Dan is a tribe in Israel. I'm stumbling over myself here a little bit. Nonetheless, we see that Esau gets killed in the end. Like in the book of Obadiah, Esau will get killed in the end. And when Cushim did this thing, the sons of Jacob prevailed over the sons of Esau, and the sons of Jacob buried their father Jacob by force in the cave, and the sons of Esau beheld it. And Jacob was buried in Hebron in the cave of Machpelah, which Abraham had bought from the sons of Heth for the possession of a burial place, and he was buried in very costly garments. And no king had such honor paid him as Joseph paid to his father at his death, for he buried him with great honor, like unto the burial of kings. And Joseph and his brethren made a mourning of 7 days for their father. So, for all the people who say that Jacob was a deceiver and a usurper and all of that, I mean, it's one thing to say that Jacob made mistakes. It's another thing to put him in the place of being a deceiver and a usurper. The evidence is that he was indeed the rightful displaced king of Israel. He was put to rest as a great king. And he was displaced as the king of Israel until such time as Jehovah would put another king on Israel's throne. And that next king was Saul. Furthermore, I want to show you something else about Esau in that he is a thief. And it proves it here in the book of Jasher. Then it says in verse 17 in the book of Jasher, chapter 47, where Esau and Jacob are burying Isaac. And in verse 17 it says, "And Jacob said to Esau, Hear you, I pray thee, what I will speak to you, saying, The Lord God of heaven and earth spoke to our fathers, Abraham and Isaac, saying, Unto your seed will I give this land for an inheritance forever. Now therefore, all that our father has left is before you, and behold, all the land is before you. Choose you from them what you desire. If you desire the whole land, take it for you, and your children forever, and I will take this riches. And if you desire the riches, take it unto you, and I will take this land for me and for my children to inherit forever." See, they were making this deal here. And in fact, it's the same deal that they made when, Esau came running in and said, "Give me some of that red stew so that I can, you know, because I'm hungry, because I don't care whether Abraham died or not. I just want to be fed." And Nebaioth, the son of Ishmael, was then in the land with his children. And Esau went on that day and consulted with him, saying, "Thus has Jacob spoken to me, and thus has he answered me. Now give me your advice, and we will hear." And Nebaioth said, "What is this that Jacob has spoken to you? Behold, all the children of Canaan are dwelling securely in their land, and Jacob says he will inherit it with his seed all the days." It's almost like Nebaioth is laughing at Jacob because, you know, here the Arab countries are all around Israel. Yeah, well, we're going to destroy you, Israel. We're dwelling safely and securely in this land. Excuse me. "Now, go therefore and take all your father's riches and leave Jacob your brother in the land as he has spoken." And Esau rose up and returned to Jacob and did all that Nebaioth the son of Ishmael had advised. And Esau took all the riches that Isaac had left, the souls, the beasts, the cattle, and the property, and all the riches. He gave nothing to his brother Jacob. And Jacob took all the land of Canaan from the brook of Egypt unto the river Euphrates. And he took it for an everlasting possession and for his children and for his seed after him forever. So when we see Jacob bowing down to Esau, yes, that was a mistake, but he got that back. And see, we don't get that recorded in the book of Genesis for us. And so this here was the same test. Tell me that Jacob usurped the place of Esau. Not on your life. Esau was more interested in the riches than he was in the land. He never wanted the land. Jacob was the only one who cared about the land. That is why the Lord hates Esau and loves Jacob. And Jacob also took from his brother Esau the cave of Machpelah, which is in Hebron, which Abraham had bought from Ephron for a possession of a burial place for him and his seed forever. And Jacob wrote all these things in the book of purchase, and he signed it, and he testified all this with 4 faithful witnesses. And so when Joseph was coming up with Jacob's body to bury it in the cave of Machpelah, and Esau stood there as a liar saying that this transaction never took place. This is what you need to know. It's Esau who is the usurper. It's Esau who is the deceiver. It's Esau who is the problem in the Middle East, along with Ishmael, who is with Esau. And these are the words which Jacob wrote in the book, saying, the land of Canaan and all the cities of the Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Girgashites. Oh, wait a minute. Those are the kings that are the ites that are listed that the Lord says when you come up on them, kill them. Don't let any of them live. But anyway, that's another story. And further on it says, all the seven nations from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates. Why? Why does this passage and then later in the Torah, it mentions these same group of people, why you're not supposed to let them live? Well, because they were vassals to the Pharaoh of Egypt. That's why they're mentioned. And the city of Hebron, Kiriath Arba, and the cave which is in it, the whole did Jacob buy from his brother Esau for value, for a possession, for an inheritance, for his seed after him forever. And Jacob took the book of purchase and the signature, the command and the statutes and the revealed book. Oh my, the revealed book, Revelation. And he placed them in an earthen vessel in order that they should remain for a long time. And he delivered them to the hands of his children. Esau took all that his father had left him after his death from his brother Jacob, and he took all the property from man and beast, camel and ass, ox and lamb, silver and gold, stones and bdellium, and all the riches which had belonged to Isaac, the son of Abraham. There was nothing left which Esau did not take to himself from all that Isaac had left after his death. Do you want to know why the Lord caused Jacob to be buried as a king in such great honor? Because of what Esau did. See? And Esau would have recognized that on Jacob's body was these stones of bdellium and other precious stones and silver and gold and all the things that Esau stole from him. And he would have recognized that the people that had came with camels and asses and ox, and I'll bet you there were lambs with them too. The Lord caused Jacob to be buried with a crown on his head and the kings to throw their crowns at his feet because of what Esau did to Jacob. And Esau took all this, he and his children, and went home to the land of Seir, the Horite, away from his brother Jacob and his children. And Esau had possessions amongst the children of Seir, and Esau returned not to the land of Canaan from that day forward. Now, we know that Esau is back in the land again in the form of the Palestinians, and then moving on, and the whole land of Canaan became an inheritance to the children of Israel for an everlasting inheritance, and Esau with all his children inherited the Mount Seir. And so Jacob secured for us, one way or the other, he secured for us the inheritance that he passed on the blessing of to Ephraim and Manasseh and to all of his children. And so now we're back in Genesis chapter 50 and verse 16. And they sent a messenger to Joseph, saying, your father did command before he died, saying, so shall you say to Joseph, forgive, I pray you now, the trespass of your brethren and their sin, for they did unto you evil. And now we pray, forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And his brethren also went and fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we be your servants. And Joseph said to them, fear not, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring to pass, as it is to this day, to save much people alive. Now therefore, fear you not, I will nourish you and your little ones, and be comforted. And he comforted them, and spake kindly to them. And Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's house, and Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation, generation, the children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were brought up upon Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from hence. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. See, even Joseph didn't have as great and kingly a burial as was honored upon Jacob. But here, Joseph teaches us the meaning of forgiveness, doesn't he? That once something is forgiven, that it's forgiven. You can't say, well, I can forgive, but I can't forget. No, you really can't say that. Joseph and Yeshua both say the same thing, that forgiveness is forgiveness. And then we're going to find out that Joseph's bones got to go home, but they got to come home when the whole house of Israel went home. When was that? When they went out of Egypt under Moses. And so that's going to be when Joseph, the Christians who are in the church, who don't understand what we understand, they're going to get to go home with us. The bones from Ezekiel chapter 37, those dry bones. Anyway, now I want to talk with you about Christmas just briefly before I close. This is not going to be a bashing session. And the reason is because this is not about whether or not we should keep Christmas. This is about the emails and the phone calls I get from people who ask me, what are you going to do or what do you do when Christmas comes around? Well, all I have to tell you is that don't participate. Just don't participate. You don't have to say anything. Just don't participate. And how I don't participate is that I make myself absent on the days that they're celebrating, you know, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I'm not present. I'm not in the house where they're having the covenant meal. I just stay away from that. And I think that says more than us flapping our lips all the time. You know, I used to be a real lip flapper with my kids, and I sometimes would get out my Torah bat and I would start beating up on them because, you know, they were supposed to see it my way. But I'll tell you what, a couple of years ago, the Lord showed me that me flapping my lips all the time wasn't getting anywhere. And so I got worried that, you know, the Lord wouldn't be able to work it out to where, you know, they could come back to him and or come to him and keep the Torah. And here's what I realized. The Ruach will call people. And when the people reject his calling, or her calling rather, the Ruach will keep calling. I have in my past many times when the Ruach called me to do things and I didn't do it. But the Ruach kept calling me, and the Ruach will do that for our loved ones as well. And so we don't have to flap our lips about Christmas. We don't have to flap it about, you know, Halloween and Easter and all the other pagan holidays they keep. All we have to do is be a light. And when I was thinking about this thing about being a light, it occurred to me this morning that I have never heard a candle flame say, hey, you need to do this different. Nor have I heard a light bulb say, hey, I'm going to beat you up if you don't come and do it the way that I think you should do it. In fact, I've never heard a candle flame or a light bulb say anything, ever. So it occurred to me that, wow, we're supposed to be a light, meaning that we're shining in the darkness, and if we're shining, we don't have to say anything. People will see. They will be able to discern the difference. And that, my friends, is what calls them. So don't be, you know, just constantly flapping your lips at your family and friends. Just go about being non-participants in their holidays and being participants in the Lord's holy days. Sabbath, the new moon, the feasts, you know, those days. Anyway, I hope that this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. I know that it's been long, but I hope that it's been worth it and that you've been blessed by it. Shabbat Shalom.